And welcome now to the midday, another action-packed hour, even more action-packed than usual. We're from our Buck studio today with live music and conversation. I'm Norman.
I'm Stephanie. Good afternoon. And we have a very special guest on the midday today, Pamela Howland. She's a classically trained pianist and an entertainer. We'll hear a little bit more about that in a moment.
Covers a lot of territory.
She received her doctorate from the Eastman School of Music in piano performance and literature. And more important for us, she was trained at the Wisconsin Conservatory of Music, and she graduated from Oconomowoc High School.
That's right.
Pamela performs extensively as a soloist around the world, as a chamber musician. She teaches at Wake Forest University and has recorded now a dozen CDs. And back in Wisconsin to appear in her hometown this Saturday night with a one-woman show called Remembering Frederick, a musical conversation between Chopin and George Sand. Welcome, Pamela.
Thank you so much. I'm so glad to be here.
All right. Tell us about this show before we get much farther, because it's a one-person show.
It is, and it is my tribute to the big Chopin 200th birthday anniversary year, which is this year. He was born in 1810 and died in 1849, and we don't like to celebrate the death year.
Right,
so
I always thought that was a little odd.
I think so, too. But what I wanted to do was do something extra special, I guess, for Chopin and for his listeners and would-be listeners. So it's not exactly a concert, although I play concert pieces. It's not just a reading, but I will read some of George Sand's writing. And it's also kind of like a play in that I play both parts, Frédéric Chopin and George Sand, who was Amantine Lucille Aurore Dupin. That was her real given name, and she became the Baroness du Devant. But she was one of those French writers, an amazing woman who had to take a man's pen name because, guess what, she couldn't get published. And they became lovers for nearly 9 years and were kind of each other's creative muses. So I wanted to, it was such a significant part of his life, I wanted to put her in the show as well.
So you've been doing this show around the country all year?
Yes, it started out in Warsaw, Poland, a year ago, August, and I created the written passages. I read them in French and Polish. And in the show, though, back home, we have a PowerPoint, so it's like super titles in an opera. So nobody needs to flip through but yet the listener has a sense of the languages that he particularly spoke.
You have a Polish connection.
I do. My grandfather actually came from Poland in 1900 as a little boy. And growing up, I didn't know much about his story at all. But in 2006, my family and I, we happened to be in Vienna for the Mozart year. That was the 250th birthday. We said, well, let's go to Warsaw and see if we can find his birthplace. And shockingly, I guess I didn't know if I really believed it existed, but it does. It's a town called Żyrardów. But it's very close to Żelazowa Wola, which is Chopin's birthplace museum home. So that really, even though it's a small tie, I don't really have relatives there now. But I have some new friends, and it really made his life and world come to life for me in a meaningful way.
How many letters do we have between Chopin and George Sand?
Well, that's the interesting thing. When I started creating this show, I thought, well, I'll just read the letters. There aren't many letters. There's just a small, slim volume, but they're very pedestrian. I need a loaf of bread. My publisher needs money.
So many composer
letters.
Get my
coat tailored. Right. And Chopin wasn't particularly literary, although Sand was. And, of course, they lived together. So you don't, you know, write too much to someone that you see on a daily basis. So what I'm drawing from is her autobiography called Histoire de ma vie, which means story of my life, which she wrote, finished about 6 years after he died. And it's not even her whole story. She outlived him by 27 years, but they had a very bad breakup. So in my show, Chopin comes back from the dead, and she always says that she talks to him all the time, but this time he has really come back. And so they have an opportunity to make some things right, which is what the show is about.
And reminisce a little bit.
Yes, and reminisce. Mm-hmm. And so Sand talks and she reads, but when Chopin responds, it's only through his music. It's a selection of mazurkas and preludes and waltzes and a nocturne.
What did she write actually about Chopin?
Well, here's a good example of a passage. Now, we have this wonderful eyewitness of Chopin, but I won't pretend to say that she was an unbiased writer. She was a very strong writer. This is afterwards. But here's the kind of writing she did. It's very polished and very poetic. She said, "The genius of Chopin is the most profoundly full of feeling that has ever existed. He made a single instrument speak the language of infinity. He did not need massive means to express his genius, neither saxophones nor ophicleides to fill the soul with terror, neither church organs nor human voice to fill it with faith and enthusiasm. Chopin was a combination of those magnificent inconsistencies that only God can create and that have their own peculiar logic." So that's kind of a setup for where she goes. In the show, I have five vignettes, and we start in Poland because he lived his short life half in Poland and then half in France. And that's where a lot of his mazurkas, which are some of his most popular pieces, come from.
He composed the mazurkas throughout his entire life.
He did.
It was one of his first types of compositions.
Yes, and the mazurka is a Polish folk dance from the Mazovia region, which is that region just south of Warsaw. And it's a peasant dance, a folk dance, but he took it and made it. He wrote over 50 of them, and I'm going to give you an example here pretty soon of one. But he put in the rhythmic elements and some of the instrumental elements into the mazurka, but then stylized it into one of those inimitable, beautiful Chopin melodic pieces that we're so familiar with.
Why don't we hear a mazurka?
What I'd like to do is demonstrate for you what makes a mazurka a mazurka.
That'd
so
be
this
great.
Is the one of the first mazurkas that he wrote, the B-flat from Opus 7.
Pamela is going from the table, speaking with us across the table, to the piano.
So here's the mazurka that everybody's familiar with. Etc. So you notice right away that it's in 3-4, and the more famous type of piece that's in 3-4 is...
A waltz,
right, which is a 1-2-3, 1-2-3. Mm-hmm. But the odd thing or interesting thing about a mazurka is that the accent is either on the second beat or the third beat, which is a syncopation. So you have 1-2-3, 1-2-3, 1-3, 1-2-3, 1-2-3, 1-2-3, like that. And that actually comes from the stomp of the heel or the hand gesture that comes from the dance. So it has that kind of off-kilter or syncopated rhythm. If I tried to turn this mazurka into a waltz, it would sound like this. 1-2-3, 1-2-3, 1-2-3, 1-2. But it would be waltz-like, but it would lose its mazurka character. This piece is sectional, like most of Chopin's writings. The next section is a little more Chopin-esque. And then he throws in a very kind of mysterious section at the end, which is modal, and it sounds like this. And so this thing... is the drone instrument.
Right. Mm-hmm.
That, you know, if you're out in the country and you're peasant-like, you're going to have a flute or a violin or somebody singing the melody. But you're going to have a bagpipe or a cello on fifths. So he throws that all in. And you don't need to know that to appreciate the piece, but I think it's kind of fun.
And it almost sounds like a cymbalum or something in the right hand there.
Yes, and he grew up on that music. And he was, of course, very homesick when he lived in France, and so he did, as Stephanie said, compose these mazurkas throughout his whole life. So I'll go ahead and play the whole thing, put it back together now, if that's all right.
This is the mazurka in B-flat from the Opus 7, number 1.
Thank you.
Wow, it's really interesting to hear it with that drone sound and having it brought to life.
It's been said that Chopin's waltzes are not for dancing, they're about dancing. Would you say that
right.
on the mazurkas, too?
I would say that very much. It's what people call a stylized piece. And I'll play you a waltz in just a little bit, but you'll hear the same thing, that you can hear the 1-2-3, 1-2-3, but it would be pretty hard to dance. And part of that is because Chopin is using this concept that he didn't actually completely originate, but people associate with him, called tempo rubato. And the rubato comes from the Italian word rubare, just to rob or to borrow or to just kind of not make it strict, so that it has a little more of that emotional give and take.
One note stealing from another.
Exactly, exactly. So, and he does that very much in the waltzes. But the waltzes represent his Parisian entry into Parisian society, I guess you could say. And they weren't maybe actually some of his favorite pieces, but he sure left some gorgeous, gorgeous waltzes. And so I think that they're reflective. They are some of the pieces that people know the best of Chopin's music, but they're not necessarily his favorites.
Well, waltzes were so wildly popular throughout Western Europe when Chopin arrived in Paris, that was
yes.
practically everything that was getting published. It always went to the front of the line if
you
it was a waltz.
Had to do it,
yes,
I imagine.
Yes, I think that's true. And, you know, how he made his livelihood, his living, was through composing and teaching. And unlike Franz Liszt, who was his counterpart, who loved performing and had, you know, groupies and women just falling all over the place. And there were a lot of people who adored Chopin, both men and women. But he was very retiring and shy, and he was very nervous, and he did not like to play for big groups of people. So for him, a salon, which was a gathering of maybe about 200 people, this is a Paris society, that was a big deal for him. And he did that, but he did that for his living, and it wasn't his favorite thing to do. There's one famous waltz that I love, and it's he did not put this subtitle appellation on it, but it's referred to as the Farewell. And he wrote it for Maria Wodzinska, who was his love that it's sort of love gone wrong. And I think that it's good for people to know that these wonderful genius composers were real people who had real struggles, real relationships, you know, difficulties. But her parents did not think he was fit. And now, you know, he was very sick, sickly,
yes.
had tuberculosis. And he would go in and out of
sanatorium.
Right, and periods of good health mm-hmm. and not. And so he loved this Maria Wodzinska. And thought he would marry her, but it didn't work out. And so this, apparently, this farewell waltz is sort of dedicated to her. And she is the one that he had to kind of disentangle from on his way to becoming involved with the sound.
Uh-huh.
So that's
so
kind
says,
of interesting.
So he says, adieu to Maria and hello, Georgine.
Yes, I think that's true. I think that's true. So if you'd like me to play it, I'd be glad to.
That would be delightful. It's all the right. Farewell Waltz.
Which, if you're keeping track, is a waltz in A-flat, Opus 69, number 1 by Chopin.
Thank you.
So our guest, Pamela Howland, performing the music of Chopin, his waltz in A-flat major from the Opus 69. That was number one, known as the Farewell Waltz.
I wonder if that was at all a convention. You know, Beethoven has that Farewell Sonata.
Right, right. Well, I think that it brings into mind these wonderful 19th century kind of emotional things that we don't, well, we have the emotions, but we don't have the same, or we have too much technology. We have to remember that he was saying his farewells and even leaving his native Poland and getting on a stagecoach, you know, if you can imagine that. I always tell my students, okay, there's no cell phone, there's no computer, there's no anything, there's no TV.
Even the mail service is a little sketchy.
Exactly. And so when Chopin did leave, when he was just about 19 years old, he left in 1830 from Warsaw, traveling west, didn't get to Paris till 1831. There was war going on at the time. But he said a farewell to his father and his family, who he adored, and they adored him. And he did not know if he would ever see them again. And in fact, he did not. Actually, I should say he never made it back to Poland. He did meet them in a spa, which is the place to take the healing waters in Germany. And Maria Wodzinska was there with his parents, but then that was the breakup point with her. So back to what you were saying, to say farewell, to write a love letter, or give somebody a token or a little etching of your portrait, that was a very, very precious thing. And I mean, I don't know if people even write that kind of email, or whether they save that or something, but this was a very personal, heartfelt thing. And the other thing that it brings up, you notice that it's not a very happy waltz. There are moments sunlight that kind of break through, which is very much like Chopin. But it is this particularly Polish emotional quality. The word for it is żal. It's Z with a little dot over it. Żal means, in our language, melancholy, but not mere melancholy. It has to do, it could be...
It's like sadness. Pity in Russian.
And, yeah, it's very similar. That's one element, but it could be sadness, nostalgia, longing, even a dreamy state, even anger. It's just this horrible feeling that you have lost something that you can never get back again. So, whether it is health or a loved one or a job, people can relate to this. And this is one of the things, that quality of Żal, that melancholy that permeates all of Chopin, that I think is so compelling for them today.
No, he did not get back to Poland because the Tsarist Russia took it over.
Exactly.
Wasn't that what prevented him?
Poor Poland. The Polish people have always been extremely strong, and strong in their heritage. But they have not really had the country per se called Poland forever. There are three marauding influences: the Russians, the Austro-Habsburgs, and what we would call the Germans or the Prussians. And in fact, my grandfather coming over in 1900, I didn't know much about it, but they'd always say, "We come from Russia, Poland." And so that was, it's just that Warsaw was in that sector on the Russian border. So, you don't want to go up against the strong sense of Polish patriotism and love of culture. And that comes in that sort of heroic and romantic, the other side of it, qualities come out in Chopin's music that I think is very stirring for people.
Has your interpretation of his music changed since you've done all this research with George Sand?
Well, I think so. I think I understand the relationship better. We don't know. We don't know what exactly happened, but I think her readings what she has left kind of guide things. There's some music that kind of pairs up with some of this, and I think we're going to do that on the second half. But it has changed my feeling, realizing that when I'm performing this Chopin, that I'm actually speaking. And Chopin talked about speaking a piece of music, that the performer should speak it, meaning, give each turn of phrase a special inflection. Don't rush. Don't drag it out. If you're communicating through notes, and through music, make it just like you would speech. So I think that's changed certainly my phrasing a bit.
How does Chopin come through as a Polish patriot in his music?
Well, I think he comes through in everything he does. There are certain turns of phrase. Of course, in the mazurkas, he's evoking the Polish spirit right there. And in his polonaises, I was going to say that's the other dance in Polish. The mazurka is the Polish folk dance. The polonaise is more of the... regal royalty dance.
Court.
And it has a yum ba 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 bum ba 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 ba. And even in some of his nocturnes, he brings that rhythm, that mm-hmm. stately rhythm in 3-4 back. But it's more the quality, I think, of Polish suffering and resistance to oppression that you can feel, and it's in that all-encompassing melancholy. But one of the things I love most about Chopin's music is that he rarely starts out, like the first piece I played is in the major key, and it sounds pretty happy, but then he comes in with that modal section mm-hmm. that's that sort of longing, wistful jal, or more commonly, he will start out in the minor mode, but then there's usually a section in the middle that goes into the major and takes you away, you know, whether sunlight comes in or he's dreaming of better times, but no, the A section, if it's an ABA form, comes back, and he comes back to that place of feeling, which is very comfortable for him.
That seems to be fairly prevalent in Eastern European music. I mean, I'm thinking, for example, of some of Dvorak's Slavonic dances
yes.
that have those contrasting sections, and
right.
Liszt also.
And I think that's absolutely true, and one of the things that people can benefit from knowing about Eastern European music, because of the modal patterns or the scale patterns that are used, even a happy piece doesn't always sound happy. Might be somebody's wedding song, and we're thinking, what? Mm-hmm. You know, this doesn't sound like
mixed
German.
Feelings.
But, well, could be mixed feelings, but it's because of the different expression, and it's really it's the language, the syntax, and the sounds used. It sounds sad and there is a lot of that longing. Whether it's due all to the political oppression, I don't know, but I think it's kind of deep in the Polish soul. And I think that is something that people really relate to in this music.
You have a connection to Poland. How about to France?
Well, ironically enough, my grandfather married a woman who was of French heritage. Mm. So they came over before 1900. But French was the language that I learned when I was, you know, in the Oconomowoc school. And it's the love of my life in terms of languages. And I've played in Paris quite a number of times. And in my performances now, even before I was doing this show, I really like to speak to the audience. Speak to the audience and give them a little bit of an idea of why was this music created. So when I go to France, I try to do that in French. And I like for people, even if they don't know the music, the language, each language is a kind of music all in and of itself. And so I think that if you aren't familiar with a foreign language, sometimes that's even happier, because if you're really listening, you can hear what are the feelings that are being expressed.
We'll be back with a story about a raindrop and the 12:30 quiz question in just a moment. You're listening to The Midday on Wisconsin Public Radio. Back to our guest, Pam Howland, and Frédéric Chopin, which is her specialty.
Well, and speaking of dandy prizes, before we jump right into the next phase, you have recorded a number of CDs, including a couple by Chopin.
Yes.
One brand new CD that's just been
right.
released.
Just last week.
Mm-hmm.
The first Chopin CD called Homeland was after my trip to Poland that very first time, and it's a selection of preludes and mazurkas and a variety of other pieces, including the famous funeral march. And then this volume two, now Chopin wrote over 230 pieces, so I guess there are a few volumes left to do. But this is mazurkas and waltzes and nocturnes. So between the combination of the two of them, I've recorded everything that is in the show. But yes, I would love for people to know about that, and they certainly can find it on my website at PamelaHowland.com.
In addition to Christmas recordings and mm-hmm. African-American art songs and all
French
kinds of...
French Impressionism, mm-hmm. yeah, some of my favorites.
All right, so now we're getting to the good part.
This is a big story, yes. What I'd like to do is, we have been sitting here talking about the raindrop, the so-called raindrop prelude. Chopin wrote 24 preludes. It's the Opus 28, and many, many people are familiar with them because some fairly, I'm going to put quotes around this, fairly easy pieces, at least technically, are mixed in with really difficult works. And so if we started the interview with Chopin in 1810 in Warsaw, and we're moving west, he moved to Paris, and then he met Sand. We're going to talk about that just a little bit, but After he met Sand, they made a very fateful vacation, quote, vacation, mm-hmm. to the Isle of Mallorca, which is an island off the coast of Spain. And a large degree of the preludes were composed there. So that's why it's relevant. But getting back to the title, Raindrop, Chopin abhorred titled pieces. He liked pieces like Prelude in D major, Sonata in B flat minor, but some of the other more flamboyant romantics loved titling them. And in fact, a Liszt pupil, Hans von Bülow, titled all of the preludes. And what Chopin didn't like about that was he wanted the listener to have their own imaginative response. And it sure does. Here, I'm going to tell you today, it sure does sound like a raindrop and a storm. And I'm going to go to the piano and just sit and do that for a second so you can hear that.
The Raindrop Prelude.
While you're finding your place, I think Chopin went to Mallorca for the sun and the warmth.
Oops.
Right?
Well, they went in November, the rainy season.
Bad planning.
We'll talk about that. But what Chopin did at the piano was take this very famous phrase. And you notice that the key feature there, besides a beautiful melody, is these A-flats that just keep going. And these are like, you know, you can imagine that these are like little gentle raindrops. And this piece is a very lovely A-B-A form. So that A chunk is this lovely, gorgeous, melodic Chopin with the gentle rain. The B section, we go to the minor key, and you're going to hear a big storm. Approaching storm. Crashing. Thunder, etc. But then we're going to return to the gentle rain. But I'd like to also set up this piece, because he did compose it on Mallorca by reading what Sand has to say.
So we actually know why this might be called the Raindrop Prelude.
Right, and you know, I think Chopin, he would hate the title, but I think, this is a big, you'll hear in the story. She was describing that his preludes are works of art, and she says, some of them bring to mind the visions of dead monks and echoes of funeral chants which besieged him, but others are mournful and sad, charming your ear, breaking your heart. What happened is that they became lovers, lived together, and they had barely begun to live together in the fall of 1838, but her son Maurice, she had two children from her former husband. She had gained her independence, which was rare in France for a woman at that time, but she was taking Maurice to Mallorca to take the cure. People had told them, go to Mallorca, it's a sunny, tropical place. Why they went in November, I don't know, but Chopin wanted to go along. So what started out as a very, I think, romantic adventure became a nightmare. They stayed in an abandoned monastery outside of the city of Palma in Valdemosa. I haven't been there yet. I hope to go next month. But it was abandoned, and he was subject to terrors, and he had a wild imagination. He wasn't in good health. And the sad thing about their relationship is that they had this glorious sort of 6 months from what we can tell, of this beautiful romance. But then from the time of being together in Mallorca, Sand realized, wow, this man is really sick, and I may have to be, you know, taking care of him for my whole life. Sand is quite vilified, too. People think, oh, she ruined his life, and many of Chopin's friends thought that, but I don't think that's the case. I think she probably prolonged his life. But let me read just really quickly in French what I just said about the funeral chants. This would be her language. Plusieurs présents dans la pensée des visions de moines trépassés et l'audition des chants funèbres qui l'a siégé. D'autres encore sont d'une tristesse morne et, en vous charmant l'oreille, vous navre le cœur. So, charming your ear, breaking your heart. So here's the big story. Here's the drama. Here we go. There is one that came to him on a gloomy, rainy evening, which makes the soul frightfully despondent. Maurice and I had left him in a healthy state that day to go to Palma to buy some necessities for our encampment. The rains had come, the torrents had overflowed. We had made 3 leagues in 6 hours, returning in the midst of a flood, and we arrived well after nightfall, without shoes, abandoned by our cart driver, through unheard-of risks. We were rushing because we knew our patient would worry. His anxiety had been severe, to be sure, but it had frozen into calm despair, and he was playing a marvelous prelude while weeping. On seeing us come in, he rose, uttered a loud cry, then said with a wild expression and in a strange tone of voice, "Ah, just as I imagined, you have died." When he had gotten back his bearings and saw the state we were in, he was sick at the retrospective display of our dangers. He confessed to me later that while waiting for us, he had seen all that in a dream, and no longer able to distinguish dream from reality, he had calmed himself and played the piano drowsily, persuaded that he had died himself. He saw himself drowned in a lake, heavy, icy drops falling rhythmically on his chest. And when I had him listen to the drops of water falling rhythmically on the roof, he denied having heard them. He was even angry at what I translated by the expression imitative harmony. He vehemently protested. And he was right, against the naivete of believing his notes to have been oral imitations. His genius, full of the mysterious harmonies of nature, translated them into sublime equivalents in his music, and not by servile imitations of sounds. His composition that evening was certainly full of raindrops, resonating on the tiles of the monastery, but they were perhaps translated in his imagination and in his music into tears from heaven falling on his heart. So, that is her very poetic rendition of how this piece that I'm going to play was composed.
No mere raindrops, these.
No mere raindrops,
these. They're transcendental raindrops.
That's right. All right, so this is the so-called Raindrop Prelude in D-flat major, opus 28, number 15.
Thank you.
The Raindrop Prelude of Frédéric Chopin with a fair amount of, I guess you'd almost say, play-by-play provided in the memoir of his lover, George Sand.
I will never hear that prelude again the same way.
No, I it has been so much fun and so deeply and profoundly interesting to be putting, for me as a pianist, who pianists are mute, you know, we never speak out loud, and for me to do this has really connected things up, and I'm very excited about this show that I have Saturday night at the Oconomowoc Arts Center, not only because I'm from there, but they have a beautiful new theater. And so they have a lot of, we'll have a, you know, set design and stage that's going to look very beautiful on Saturday night. But I designed this show so that I could play it like I did in Warsaw. I didn't know I was going to be playing outside in a garden with no amplification, so be played for anybody. But I think there's something, as like with the Raindrop Prelude, in here for everyone.
Let's talk about the Art Center for just a moment. Mm-hmm. If you're interested in tickets, it's the Oconomowoc Art Center, 262-560-3172 is the phone number. It's very easy just to do a search for Oconomowoc Art Center, or you can look at PamelaHowland.com, and both of those websites will get you to Saturday night's performance information. It's at 7:30 at the Oconomowoc Art Center.
Time to repeat today's 12:30 quiz question. Give you another about 9 minutes to weigh in with your answer to that. The question today, what distinction do they share? A.M. Bernard, Ellis Bell, George Eliot, Marcus Holland, Max Reiner, and A.N. Rocalar. That's the question. You can email your answer at midday@wpr.org.
Or you can call, and you'll be speaking to Angie at 800-442-7106.
Chopin didn't invent the nocturne, but he took it to a whole new level.
That's exactly right. The nocturne is another genre or type of piece of Chopin that people just absolutely love. And it was the Irish pianist John Field who just before, earlier in the 1800s, had titled a piece Nocturne or Night Piece. And it was the beginning of the wave of, literary influence on Romanticism, where people wanted to give evocative, emotional, expressive titles to pieces. But Chopin loved the idea. And in the Nocturnes, and there are 19 of them that are usually played, they're so gorgeous, but they're all different. Many of them, though, have some of Chopin's hallmark harmonic and melodic and pianistic techniques, like opening up the left hand so you've got a wide arcing, you're going to hear that in one that I'll play, a wide arcing left hand accompaniment and beautiful singing melody, a lot of ornamentation, and usually, now some of them are in the major key, but a lot of that emotional intensity, zhal, ranging all over the place. It's that sadness and frustration and longing for getting back something that is gone in the night, like a nocturne.
Oh, where was he with his health when he wrote most of the nocturnes?
Well, now he did write these. This is another genre, like the mazurkas, that he wrote throughout his life. But he was largely at George Sand's country estate called Noan, which is about 2 hours south of Paris. And when they were in good times, he would try to compose there in the summer. And as she said, when he every summer he came back to Noan full of eagerness and expectation. But the minute he started writing again, everything turned gloomy. So, in fact, I'd love to read you a passage about what she has to say about his compositional process. Would that be all right?
Right.
Okay. And she says, his creativity was spontaneous, miraculous. He found it without seeking it, without expecting it. It arrived at his piano suddenly, completely, sublimely, or it sang in his head during a walk, and he would hasten to hear it again by recreating it on his instrument. But then would begin the most heartbreaking labor I have ever witnessed. It was a series of efforts, indecision and impatience, to recapture certain details of the theme he had heard. What had come to him all of a piece, he now overanalyzed in his desire to transcribe it, and his regret at not finding it again neat, as he said, threw him into despair. He would shut himself up in his room for days at a time, weeping, pacing, breaking his pens, repeating or changing a single measure 100 times, writing it and erasing it with equal frequency, and beginning again the next day with desperate perseverance. He would spend 6 weeks on a page, only to end up writing it just as he had done in his first outpouring. That is my favorite quote of hers.
Yes. See where there'd be some emotion in there. Let's hear the final product of one of those, I can only call it storm and stress, experiences of Chopin.
This is the E minor nocturne, which apparently he began early in his career, possibly on the death of his sister, but which he finished up at the very end of his career. This is the last nocturne he wrote.
An E minor nocturne, that would be Opus 72, number 1 by Chopin. Our guest today, played it and has been illuminating the life and struggles of Frédéric Chopin and those around him.
And she'll be doing that this Saturday night at the Oconomowoc Arts Center. The number is 262-560-3172. Or you can also check her website, PamelaHowland.com. Pamela, thank you very much for being our guest. It's been a real pleasure.
It's been my pleasure entirely. Thank you.
Yeah, best of luck with what sounds like a compelling show.
Thank you so
Next
much.
Project, Debussy, 2012.
Be there.
That's right.
We'd like to thank our engineer, Brad Kohlberg, also Laurie Skelton, Angie Whittakin, and Ramona Gaspar for contributing to today's edition of The Midday.
Live from Buck's studio.
Right here on Wisconsin Public Radio.